From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the roots music and movie scores of Ry Cooder. He first became known for his bottleneck guitar playing. Now his most famous music is from his score for Paris, Texas, brooding guitar lines that have since been used for Molson beer commercials. Cooder co-founded the new band Little Village along with John Hyatt and Nick Lowe. Well, tonight is the Tonight Show's big night. TV critic David Bianculli joins us to pay homage, and we call up someone who's been with the show even longer than Carson, Tommy Newsom, the assistant director of the orchestra. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a book and a film about dogs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A Superior Court judge in Los Angeles has ruled that LAPD officer Lawrence Powell will be retried in LA County for the beating of Rodney King. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Defense attorney Michael Stone argued that the political turmoil that convinced a state appeals court to move the first trial to neighboring Ventura County is perhaps even more pronounced now, with the threat of more violence if his client is acquitted.
This case, these riots, this threat of violence is so much a part of Los Angeles right now that I don't think we can escape it anywhere within the corners of this county.
But Judge Stanley Weisberg said the threat of violence would remain no matter where the trial was held. He did allow what he called a cooling period and pushed the trial date back until mid-October. Attorney Stone said he would probably appeal the ruling. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
The Defense Department has announced cutbacks at 63 overseas military installations. Some facilities will be closed while others will have cut staff. Most facilities on the list are in Europe. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Two of the bases are in South Korea, the other 61 are in Europe, and most of those are in Germany. According to the Pentagon announcement, this will affect more than 6,000 soldiers, 800 American civilians, and cost an estimated 2,500 local jobs in Germany, Britain, Greece, Turkey, Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, and Spain. The cuts in South Korea will reduce U.S. forces there by 246. So far, 559 overseas installations have been closed, cut back, or mothballed since the end of the Cold War. The Bush administration wants U.S. forces in Europe to be cut in half, from about 300,000 to about 150,000 by 1995. Many in Congress say cuts should go much deeper than that. The bases being closed will be returned to the host governments. Some of the largest include Payden Barracks, Pond Barracks, and Robinson Barracks, all in Germany. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The Senate Ethics Committee says it will not investigate sexual misconduct charges that nine women have lodged against Senator Brock Adams of Washington State. The committee wrote a letter to the National Organization for Women and said the alleged incidents took place before Adams took office in January 1987. The one incident that allegedly happened while Adams was a senator has already been investigated by the U.S. Attorney's Office. That investigation concluded the charge was without merit. Adams has already announced he will not run for re-election. The Seattle Times wrote a series of articles about the allegation, which led to the senator's announcement. He has firmly denied the charges. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 8 points to close at 3386.77. Trading was moderate. This is NPR. The United Nations has voted to accept three former Yugoslav republics as members of the world body. Croatia, Slovenia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina were admitted today into the UN. The assembly voted by acclamation after the Security Council recommended admission for the new countries. The remainder of Yugoslavia is made up of Serbia and Montenegro, which is claiming all of the old Yugoslavia's assets. Another republic, Macedonia, is also seeking independence. The Canadian government was under fire yesterday after a British newspaper published a report that Canada and France were spying on one another. Opposition politicians were particularly upset at suggestions that France may have been having covert dealings with Quebec separatists. Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
The report was published in this weekend's edition of The European, a London-based weekly newspaper. It was based upon a confidential diplomatic communique. The document was written by a woman who had been the Paris representative of the province of Quebec. Quebec has always had particularly close ties to France, since most Quebecers speak French. The communique outlined a spy versus spy war between Canada and France. Canada's counter-espionage agency was spying on French diplomats in Ottawa and even upon Quebec's representatives in Paris. In turn, the French were spying on Canadian diplomats. The whole affair has apparently soured Canada-France relations. However, both countries are denying everything. Both Canada and France have said the report is nonsense and that relations are just fine. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
Orion Pictures Corporation, producer of such films as Silence of the Lambs and Dances with Wolves, is talking with potential investors and expects to emerge from bankruptcy this fall. Columbia Pictures, Savoy Pictures, Republic Pictures, and MGM Path Communications are among the firms that have expressed an interest in acquiring Orion or investing in it. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American roots music is the specialty of my guest, Rai Cooter. He's made around 10 albums featuring his versions of blues, jazz, gospel, depression ballads, Tex-Mex, and rock and roll. He's an accomplished guitarist who first built his reputation on his bottleneck technique. Cooter's done a lot of guitar session work, composed many movie scores, and now he's in a supergroup of performers who've never been superstars. The band Little Village is made up of four individualistic performers, John Hyatt, Nick Lowe, Jim Keltner, and of course Cooter, each of whom has had a devoted following of their own. They first worked together on Hyatt's 1987 record, Bring the Family. For their new album, Little Village, Cooter, Keltner, Hyatt, and Lowe collaborated on writing the songs and alternated on lead vocals. Here's Rai Cooter singing. Is Little Village getting you back into touring and performing? And had you practically given that up?
Oh no, far from it. I mean, I like to play. I don't like to tour because I don't like to travel that way. But we all love to play, so naturally you have to find an excuse. You know, you have to say, well, if it's going to be a record project, we'll have an excuse to call us together or get people together, or if we're going to go out and go for the kind of physical spontaneity part or the vibe part, we'll go out and tour and play and hit the stage and go for broke and try it, you see. And that's a kind of a thing that you look forward to doing. It's just that some of the stuff I've done, it hasn't been particularly high profile, I must say, although You want to, most musicians I know, they want to kind of try different things. They want to stay wondering, you know, stay on the what-if side. That's the best part about being a musician. What-if is calling you all the time.
Over the years, you've learned and played so many different kinds of music, all forms of blues, Tex-Mex, Hawaiian music. I'm wondering if there's a music that you consider to be your roots.
No, well, Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that really. There's so much I've heard for so many years. Although maybe Johnny Cash. I mean, the first thing I ever heard that I really related to on the radio as a child was Johnny Cash. I mean, after hearing Beethoven and stuff, but I can't say that Beethoven's a root guy for me. But I mean, before Woody Guthrie is there, and there's a kind of a funny area of music hardly made anymore by marginal white people that I really loved as a kid, which was this kind of country blues thing, and it's also played by black people, of course, you know. But I mean, early on, before I ever heard blues players, I heard Woody and I heard Johnny Cash, and I used to think, these guys are really, wherever they are, and I had no idea where they were. You know, I lived in Santa Monica. As far as I knew, this was what life was. I had no idea, you know, that there was another world of culture or lifestyle out there. And, you know, I would have loved to have gone to these places, but the best thing I could do was turn on the radio at the time.
Do you think of yourself now as a, or have you thought of yourself over the years as a marginal white person?
Yeah, I sure do. I mean, I think that's the best place to be is on the margin, out there on the periphery somewhere, hanging on, because it allows you to do two things. You can see in. You have a kind of a luxury if you're on the edge looking in. You can see the whole picture if you've trained yourself or if you're in the habit of looking that way. And music's a way of seeing, you know. It's a way of understanding people or situations or life or the world through the sound. If you listen in, you hear things other than notes is all I'm saying. And the other good thing about being on the margin is you see out away from the middle. So you're sort of, you know, and you can drop off the planet a little once in a while and go see the Tex-Mex guys in McAllen, Texas, or the Hawaiian folks over there on the beach somewhere, you know, because you're not committed or you're not locked into a one way or another of seeing and thinking, you know. So I tend to stay on the edge, the periphery there, as long as it's possible anyhow.
How were you exposed to blues when you were growing up?
Well, it was hard to be exposed to blues living in Santa Monica, you see. There wasn't anybody playing blues. And then you could listen to radio station KGFJ. Hunter Hancock would once in a while sneak in a Jimmy Reed record or something like maybe Lowell Fulson or somebody. And so you said, well, that's different. That's interesting. And then along came the folk revival and the blues revival attached to it, like the baggage car, and or actually the coal car, the burner. And along came Chris Strachwitz, and he with our Hooli Records, and he found Lightning Hopkins for us, and brought us, you know, he brought us in to see some people like that. And there was the Ash Grove, the nightclub in L.A. that featured some of these by then older guys who were still active. And as far as they were concerned, it was just another way of making some money, and another audience happened to be white. And of course, for me, it was tremendous just to get in a car and drive to Hollywood and see these guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Sleepy John Estes, just apparently from Mars or some planet where people looked like this, talked like this, had strange clothes and shoes that turned up on the toes with the orange soles. I just could not imagine where these people were coming from, but you knew you wanted to go with them. It's Pied Piper-like thing, you know. I must have been about 12, 13 when all that started to happen.
Were you ever disappointed by how they sounded in person?
Oh, yeah. I wanted it to be just like the record. At first I did, anyhow. I thought, can't he play that lick I love so much? Then I learned, of course, that's not the way music works. That's not the way people work. See, it's an education there. And it was fun then to find that things could change and you could, you know, you didn't have to. In other words, it wasn't just a matter of recreating. If you wanted to experience this music, you weren't really supposed to recreate in yourself what had happened at that moment in time in, say, 1929 or 1940 or something. You were just supposed to just learn to surf across the wave of this thing, you know, just catch the groove. But nobody can tell you that. You have to kind of feel that for yourself, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist and composer Rye Cooter, and he's now playing with the band Little Village, which also includes John Hiatt, Jim Keltner, and Nick Lowe. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rye Cooter, and he's now a member of the group Little Village, along with John Hiatt, Jim Keltner, and Nick Lowe. Early in your career, you did some session work with groups like Paul Revere and the Raiders, and they had the hits like Kicks and Good Thing, and Jackie DeShannon, who recorded What the World Needs Now, and you were on one of the Stones records doing some studio work. How did you get from, you know, the folk scene to studio work?
Yeah. Well, that was quite a leap, although it wasn't the leap it is now. I mean, I guess what happened was, there was all, there was suddenly a moment when folk rock was viable commercially. You know, it, I guess thanks to Bob Dylan and then the Byrds, and this all hit in L.A. like a ton of bricks. I mean, it really went off. It set a lot of flares up. See. And suddenly everybody was into music and the Beatles and everything. And you could, I went to Santa Monica High School, you know, music was considered just as ridiculous. It was absolutely déclassé, outré thing to be interested in, even talk about, until the Beatles had their hit. And then everybody started letting their hair grow and talking about this stuff. I mean, it was like a social fact. It was like an atmosphere in your life that was never to go away. So I was, of course, very contemptuous. I thought, you know, these people just don't understand. We already knew that, you know, this stuff is already out there. So since I had no, I didn't relate to what was going on in school and things, and so used to hang out with musicians who were older and hung out at these little folk clubs and stuff. And by Taj Mahal appeared on the scene. He came out from Cambridge. And we would sit around and play, and we liked the same stuff. So he said, well, look, these guys, the Byrds, they're working. There's the, Bob Dylan's... he's working, you know, lets us work. And so we went to Ed Pearl, who ran the Ash Grove, and said, here we are, and give us a job. And he did, naturally. You know, didn't pay us anything, but said, open for somebody, you know, just do some songs. And then we did that, and then make a long, pretty long story, a little shorter, we went on, and the record companies had awakened to the fact that they might have somebody out there, there might be something they could do, and turn this... the sort of folk garage band thing into product, you know. And we got signed to Columbia Records, and we had this band, and it was terrible. But it was really no good for anything except that it got us in the door at the record company, which in those days that door was big and it was closed.
So how did you get signed to play your own music after doing studio work?
Well, I had done a lot of studio work with Lenny Warnker, who... he's the president of Warner Brothers Records now, actually. At that time, he was an A&R man, a producer. And he was producing Randy Newman and Van Dyke Parks, sort of. Gosh, I forget now. There I go, forgetting. But anyhow, we worked together a lot. And I don't know, at some point, there was some conversation, I suppose. I might have said, I think I should make a record. And he said, I think you should make a record or something. And it wasn't any more ceremonial than that. And I was about 23 at the time.
Let me play something from your first album, which was called Rye Cooter. And I think I'll play the Sleepy John Estes song, Going to Brownsville. This is you on mandolin.
Yeah.
So
Doug Kershaw's on accordion on that one, I think.
So mm-hmm. Tell me something about your arrangement for this and playing blues mandolin.
Well, Sleepy John had a... man he worked with, Yank Rachel, who was the blues mandolin player of choice, I guess, and that whole style, it's such a wonderful, hidden, forgotten thing. I mean, the jug band style that preceded Sleepy John Estes, and he kind of went into it in his own funny, weird way, and then I went into his tune in my weird little funny way. It's just a process, you see, how rhythm is and how instruments are approached, and that's kind of what this is all about, you see. It's what can you do with something as simple and basically primitive as that? Two chords and just a mood.
This is Rye Cooter from his very first album, the very first song he recorded. It's Going to Brownsville. Most of your recent recordings have been soundtrack recordings, including Paris, Texas, probably your best known, The Long Riders, Johnny Handsome, name a few more.
Oh, Alamo Bay, Louis Malle film, that was a nice one. Mm-hmm. I think I like that one. And Crossroads is another one of Walter Hill's pictures. I worked with him on the Good Blues Story. Had a lot of good stuff. The Border was a great one with Jack Nicholson, and it was a Tony Richardson film about illegal aliens and things. That was a good one. Well, there's a few more.
Everyone's afraid to hire someone who doesn't have experience doing what it is you're hiring them to do. So you got hired to do the Long Riders soundtrack before you'd ever written for a film before. Did you have to fake it at first? Did you have to fool everybody into thinking that you really knew what you were doing?
Well, luckily for me, you know, I had done a lot of work with Jack Nitzsche, who had helped me had helped me learn a way of doing this kind of work. And he was doing films in the 60s and 70s, and of course still is. And from working with him, I picked up a kind of a MO for myself, you know, and certainly found that I enjoyed looking at images and at stuff on the screen, and it was very natural for me to just sort of hear what went along with it. I think as a kid I used to hear the music and imagine the visuals, sort of, you might say. But the Long Riders didn't scare me. I just thought, well, it was the easiest thing in the world. It's a snap. Show me your film, I'll score. Well, I found out better later on.
I should mention that the Long Riders is a Western about the James and the Younger gangs. Mm-hmm. Now, I think your best-known soundtrack is what you wrote for Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm. You wrote this really kind of lonely, brooding kind of blues, but very, very kind of spacious, with lots of space between notes, lots of just notes resonating. Do you know what I mean? So can you tell me a little bit how it certainly matches the mood of the movie? It's a pretty perfect fit, but maybe you could tell us a little bit how you came up with the sound for that film. Actually, before you tell us, why don't I play the most familiar part of that soundtrack? So maybe now you could tell us a little bit about, you know, creating that kind of mood musically.
Well, Wim called me up.
This is Wim Wenders, the director.
Wim Wenders, the director, called me from Berlin. He said he'd made a film. He wanted me to do the music. He'd see me in 3 days. So he came out to, and that was about all he said. He came out to Los Angeles, and he was in somebody's house, and he had this thing on video cassette, this film, Paris, Texas, which I knew nothing about, and went up there and took a look at it. With no music, just the empty, silent kind of strange interior monologue that this thing is, and I thought, well, Lord, you know, this is great, and it's very beautiful, and what? Hopefully, he'll know what he wants. You see, because it could go, you could do. People, you never know what directors are thinking, because you hope that they're thinking of something, but if they are, they better let you know, and it's important to pick up on the right thing so you don't go wasting everybody's time. So anyhow, he had found this Blind Willie Johnson piece. Actually, I had recorded it some years back, called Dark as the Night, which is a kind of a modal study. It's just a bottleneck song that Blind Willie, it's the music of the spheres. I mean, it's some sort of root note thing. It's some sort of cosmic mood piece that the great Blind Willie Johnson had laid down for all time. And as far as Wim Wenders is concerned, this was the territory to be in. This was the place to go for this guy, because it was going to be the music of the man, the Harry Dean Stanton character, Travis, what it was like to be in his head, you know, not to say that he goes around whistling this thing, but that he's coming from a place where things, if they had a musical identity, this is what it would be, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing outside in this film except empty space, the sky and the ground and the railroad tracks. So you have to say, well, we're operating in some other conscious area here, you know. So we can't be too linear, we can't be too lyrical. If you have a lot of counterpoint and a lot of rhythm and a lot of musical ideas going on, it's just going to turn this little film over and sink it. See, it's going to be like you're going to rock the boat too hard in a very sensitive situation. So I figured he knew what he wanted, and I could hear this piece, and what I did was I kind of broke it down to some even simpler elements, maybe four-note element, and began to take that little theme, as it were, and try to develop it in a way that it could be heard or felt, hopefully not as somebody thinking real hard, and hopefully not as somebody reacting real hard and using all their brain. And what you want to do in a situation like this is turn your brain off. You know, people say, "Oh, you're not using your brain here." Well, you can't operate in this way if you're using your brain too hard, because you're just thinking and thinking and thinking. So you want to shut it off and get to the thing that you feel, you know.
I think it was Molson's who used your theme for their beer
yeah.
commercial.
That's right.
So they must have come to you and asked for permission to use it. You had to sell it to them, right?
Actually, what I did was I went and played it, and I played it again. And of course, now I don't do this as a rule, but you know, I thought, well, let's try it and see. It got to be where people were. They still do want to use this thematic little thing. This little it's almost a cliche now. You want to hear this guitar out there with the kind of drone underneath, and I've had to, you know. Had to receive requests from cigarette companies and automobiles and cars and clothes, and they want to sell a lot of stuff with this, which is very odd because you certainly never had that in mind. And it's, you know, it's not the most unpackaged sound I can make, and yet right. It's the one that the packagers like the best. Isn't that odd? Isn't that strange?
Are you glad that you did this for Molson's? Has it helped you a lot financially in a good way and given you more freedom? Where do you draw the line about when to and when not to use music for a commercial?
No, the Molson thing was a fee job. It was a very small fee. It was very small, and it's money I probably put into the yard. You know, got some a bigger lemon tree or something. And you know, you spend that money, and then you don't even remember what those
I thought
deals
you would have made
don't...
a fortune on that. They've used
no,
it so
no,
much.
No, no, no. I'm afraid not. I wouldn't mind making some real good money on an easy job. Although the more I try to do that stuff, the harder. You know, you can't go and do it for other reasons. It doesn't quite work. The truth of the matter is that. The real rich advertising money comes from something I don't know what. It certainly wasn't Molson's. I guarantee you that.
So what are you working on now?
Well, we're doing Little Village, and that's almost full-time job because it, you know, you have to go and play, and then you have to rest. That's part of your job is resting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go out again. We're getting ready to go out in Europe and come back through the United States, and I'm also sort of starting to wonder about a few things. You know, I used to spend a lot of time being with musicians and people in funny places, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of that, and I'm sort of starting to miss that now. I haven't done that in a long time. I got a kind of hankering to go out there and sit under a tree somewhere with somebody. I mean, who knows, you know? We'll see.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rye Cooter. He's a member of the band Little Village, which has a new record called Little Village. Here's Cooter from his first record. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For about a month, Johnny Carson and his Tonight Show staff have been gearing up for their final show. After tonight, comedian Jay Leno takes over. Coming up, we talk about the end of an era with TV critic David Bianculli and with Tommy Newsom, the assistant director of the Tonight Show Orchestra. And Maureen Corrigan reviews two stories about heroic dogs, the film Beethoven, and the children's book The Adventure of Taxi Dog and Maxie the Hero. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The U.S. is imposing diplomatic and economic sanctions against Serbia, the main part of what's left of Yugoslavia. Secretary of State James Baker says Serbia is to blame for the warfare in Bosnia, which declared independence from Yugoslavia in February. Among the punishments Baker is imposing, the shutdown of two consulates in the U.S. and the withdrawal of the U.S. ambassador from Belgrade. Thousands of women and children who were held hostage by Serbian gunmen in Bosnia are now reported to have crossed safely into Croatia, Pierre Vickery reports.
According to radio hams in the Adriatic port city of Split, a convoy of dozens of buses and hundreds of trucks and cars has finally crossed the Croatian border after a nightmare journey through Serbian-controlled territory. Thousands of women and children were held hostage for several days as Yugoslav army commanders negotiated safe passage for Serbian troops trapped in federal barracks. Despite growing international condemnation, Yugoslav artillery batteries have continued their heavy bombardment, pounding a number of towns in Bosnia-Herzegovina and neighboring Croatia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The price of crude oil and gasoline is expected to rise a bit in the second half of this year, following a decision by the members of OPEC not to increase output. Peter Hoffer reports from Vienna.
At a summit meeting of OPEC oil ministers, the price hawks won a victory, as it was decided to keep output at present levels of 23 million barrels per day, despite an anticipated increase in demand on the world oil market. The decision was a compromise between Saudi Arabia, that wants to increase its output to pay for the Gulf War, while Iran wants a further production cut in order to jack up prices. OPEC is aiming for $21 a barrel, but presently the so-called OPEC basket of crudes is valued at only $18.40 a barrel. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Hoffer in Vienna.
A California judge has ruled that Officer Lawrence Powell will be retried in Los Angeles County. Powell will face one count in the beating of Rodney King. The judge said everyone knows the story of the acquittal of four Los Angeles police officers on all but one charge by a jury in Ventura County and about the riots that followed the verdicts. So he said there is no point in moving the trial to another county, seeking a jury that has not heard the news reports. Powell's attorney had argued that his client could not get a fair trial in Los Angeles. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining 8 points to close at 3386.77. This is NPR. The National Organization for Women is blasting the Senate Ethics Committee for failing to pursue an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct against Washington Senator Brock Adams. Jennifer Schmidt of member station KPLU reports.
The National Organization for Women called for a Senate investigation after the Seattle Times published a story in which eight unidentified women accused Adams of sexual harassment and rape. In a letter to Norlene Caponin, president of the Washington State chapter of NOW, the Senate committee says a newspaper article using unidentified sources is not evidence. But Caponin says the women in the Seattle Times article were willing to testify against Adams had the committee proceeded with legal action. Caponin says it's clear the committee felt it was more important to protect one of their own than to protect women's rights.
It's a message, really, to women that, again, we don't matter.
Senator Brock Adams has consistently denied any wrongdoing. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Schmidt in Seattle.
Official vote counters say Fidel Ramos leads the Philippine presidential election. Waiting for the slow process to be completed, rival Miriam Defensor Santiago has charged fraud in the vote count. She says she will fast until death if necessary to protest irregularities. Another candidate, an ally of the late president, Ferdinand Marcos, says his private tally shows him in the lead. President Corazon Aquino's chief aide says some cases of vote fraud have been confirmed, but he says they don't amount to enough to affect the outcome of the election. Mrs. Aquino supports Ramos, who leads the official tally. Chinese news reports say 91 people have died in rainstorms and landslides in three provinces. The reports say storms hit the south, southwest, and northwest. Eastern and southern China receive heavy rains every spring, but they began early this year. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. As we approach the dog days of summer, Maureen Carrigan has a review of a book and a movie with two new canine heroes.
I'm a sucker for movies about giant furry animals who rescue people. By now, I've watched Mighty Joe Young at least 7 times. So this past week, when I visited my niece and nephew, ages 4 and 5, I used them as cover to go see the new doggy story, Beethoven. The movie was a delight. The car ride home, a horror. Over and over, I heard, "Can we get a puppy, please? Pretty please?" The kids made Beethoven the dog look even more lovable. In the movie, he barks, sometimes he growls, but he never, ever whines. Beethoven is a 160-pound St. Bernard with the most baleful brown eyes, who stars in the movie that's being touted as this summer's Home Alone on 4 paws. Beethoven the dog foils a puppy napping ring run by an evil veterinarian who's played by Dean Jones. But the movie Beethoven often strays from its action-adventure plot to gnaw on a juicier bone of contention these days, the American family. Beethoven's canine cure for the dysfunctional human family he lives with is to convince the mom that it's natural for her to stay at home with her litter, and to train the dad, played by Charles Grodin, to be top dog around his house. You see, Beethoven is a rather patriarchal pooch. In fact, he and Dan Quayle share similar views on family life. Like Quayle, Beethoven believes that healthy families must have strong fathers. The minute Charles Grodin snarls, lifts his hind leg in the air, and marks his territory, his dysfunctional family recovers and becomes affectionate and frisky. I give the movie Beethoven 4 liver snaps out of a possible 5. Its star is a pedigree act, but its politics belong in the pound. Now, the dog who really makes my tail wag is Maxie, the hero of the 2 taxi dog books. They're supposed to be for kids, but I've kept the copies I originally bought as birthday presents. Maxie is a big, smiling mutt who rides with his human pal Jim in a yellow checkered cab. He also has a very fetching way with a rhyme. Here's how Maxie introduces himself. "Jim drives a big taxi, and I'm his dog Maxie. Each morning we rise with the sun. We greet our boss Lou, have a biscuit or two, then set out to make our first run." Maxie works like a dog. He's out there every day battling city traffic and entertaining passengers. In the latest book, Maxie the Hero, he even nabs a purse snatcher. The taxi dog books are illustrated with golden, Edward Hopper-like pictures of brownstones, hot dog stands, and elevated subway trains. They celebrate work, the diversity of city life, and the wonderful surprises it still contains. But best of all, the partnership of Jim and Maxie shows that loving families come in all shapes and collar sizes. Both Beethoven and Maxie are irresistible, and I doubt if kids care about or even pick up on their different political messages. But as an adult Bowser buff, I'd rather ride along with Maxie than watch Beethoven's reactionary shaggy dog story any day.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. This is Fresh Air. Tonight belongs to The Tonight Show. After close to 30 years as the host, Johnny Carson is ending his reign. But you knew that. Carson's fans have been paying tribute for weeks. In a few minutes, we'll talk to someone who's been with the show even longer than Carson, Tommy Newsom, the assistant director of The Tonight Show Orchestra. Last night, there were several minutes of applause before Carson could begin his opening monologue.
Well, anyway, it's almost over. You know what? I feel like a chicken. And the colonel is whipping up those 11 herbs and spices. All we have is tonight and tomorrow, and I'm gone. God, I haven't used that line since World War II. Friend, yes, my dear, I'm going overseas. Mm-hmm.
Well, needless to say, one of the zillions of people who will be watching Carson's farewell this evening is our TV critic, David Bianculli. David, welcome.
Hi.
Do you think that the end of The Tonight Show as we know it warrants the kind of fuss that's being made?
Yeah, I really do, especially since very few shows last as long as The Tonight Show has lasted, you know, prior to Carson. But for one guy to sit there for 30 years and really hold America in court is fascinating. And he's probably the closest we've got to Will Rogers. And I think that his passing is being noted pretty much in proportion.
Why do you think the show lasted as long as it did?
Well, first, there was no competition for a long time. By the time there was competition, they were trying to ape him, and he had established such a dominant, loyal audience that it wasn't going. Now, his audience has been eroding, as all of television's audience has been eroding. So in 5 or 6 years, I would say that Carson may have been assailable. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm sure that he's stopping is while he's still on top.
Why is he stopping? Is it the network that's showing him the door?
No. No, the network would love to have him stay. It's not coincidental that his last week on television is the last week of the May sweeps. I mean, they begged him to stay here to get that, you know, this long, to get that last little drop of blood out of the stone. But I think he made noises about this a couple years ago and then last year, and I really think he wants to step back. I don't think he's retiring, though.
You've been watching the show the past couple of weeks when everybody's been very self-conscious about it being the end. Yeah. How has the show looked to you?
I've actually had more fun watching the Carson show this month than at any other time that I watched it in about 10, 15 years. I mean, they've basically thrown out the we've got to sell something kind of deal, and they're there to pay homage to him, and since he doesn't really feel too comfortable with that, he shifts it back, and there's no spotlight, so they talk. And they reminisce, and it's like conversations. It's like what The Tonight Show under Jack Parr used to be like, and it's really fun.
Is there any Tonight Show lore that you know about that you could share with us?
I just find it interesting how at each end of The Tonight Show era, it was like, we have lost this thing, we will never get it back, it is terrible, you know, no one could ever be as good. I mean, when Steve Allen left The Tonight Show, that was supposed to be it, you know, because nobody was ever going to be as zany or as clever or crazy. Then Jack Parr comes in, and no one is ever going to be as open or as raw or as emotional, as unpredictable as Jack Parr was. Then this snot-nosed Johnny Carson comes in, and he matures into this no one is ever going to be the ultra host that Johnny is. And so Jay Leno, I think, is going to do just fine. The Tonight Show itself is the institution, and I think that Jay will not be the same as Johnny, but he is keeping the monologue, and that was something that Johnny Carson brought to The Tonight Show, which I think is now its strongest point.
So are you thinking of this as the end of an era, and if so, exactly what's being ended?
Yeah, it's the Carson era is being ended, which is really significant. I mean, he's a guy that everybody trusted who watched him, and everybody, I mean, his humor, because it was inoffensive, was there. Our mass media is not so mass anymore. And Carson, like Cronkite, you know, had the power to sort of reach out to everybody at the same time. And I don't think Leno is going to do that. But I think that Carson is going to be missed. But I also think he's going to be back. I think he's going to be either taking tonight shows on the road or doing television production. He's already set up some sort of a office space in Malibu, so he's not retiring. He's just stopping what he's doing.
Well, David, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Enjoy the show tonight.
Yeah, I will.
And I've got a record I want to play for you.
Okay.
Okay. This is, I think, one of the most endearing but loopy tributes I've ever heard to Johnny Carson. It's from a Beach Boys album called The Beach Boys Love You. And this is a Brian Wilson song. And as we all know from the song In My Room, Brian Wilson spent a lot of time in his room. And judging from this song, he probably spent a lot of time listening and watching television in his room. This is Brian Wilson's song called Johnny Carson.
He sits behind his microphone. Johnny Carson. He speaks in such a manly tone.
David Bianculli, what'd you think?
Well, it's no wonder I love working on Fresh Air. You guys are such sick puppies. obviously, that was, I looked up the date of copyright on that album, which I hadn't seen, and it was 77, so it was long after Wilson had sort of visited the other side. And I think they just, it sounds like they just wanted to get on The Tonight Show in the worst way.
I love the record. My favorite line is, when guests are boring, he fills up the slack.
Yeah. But I won't take that personally that you like that much at this particular moment.
Well, David, coming up, we have an interview with Tommy Newsom, who's the assistant director of the Tonight Show Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll hear today about a Los Angeles judge's decision to hold the retrial of police officer Lawrence Powell in Los Angeles. Of course, he was one of the four police officers whose trial was moved to Ventura County. It was held in Simi Valley. They're charged with beating Rodney King. Also today, we'll hear about the riots in Las Vegas, Nevada, that began right after the Rodney King beating verdict, and have not stopped, have gone on ever since. Also today, a story about why green, environmentally sound products aren't selling very well, and what animals are doing when they talk or vocalize.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Thank you. Tonight's not just the last night for Johnny Carson, it's the last night for the Tonight Show Orchestra. When Jay Leno takes over on Monday, Branford Marsalis will lead a seven-piece band. Tommy Newsom has been a saxophonist in the Tonight Show Orchestra since 1962. In fact, he started 1 month before Carson became the host. And in 1968, Newsom became the orchestra's assistant music director. When Doc Severinsen was on the road, it was Newsom who bantered with Carson. We called up Newsom at the studio in a rehearsal break to ask him if he thought this was the end of a musical era.
It is, in a way, yeah. It's the last big band on television, on any kind of program that I can think of now. When we started, this was not even a big band. I mean, compared to some of the other programs like Kraft Music Hall and Perry Como and things like that.
Do you know how the kind of banter between Johnny and Doc or Johnny and you got started? You know, how that's become such a kind of a late night tradition.
Yeah, well, it's like a long standing thing. Like it started with Jack Benioff, maybe way before him, but he always had a deal with his band leader. If you've heard any of those programs, like with Phil Harris, was his band leader. And there were jokes about his drinking and Gleason had it with Sammy Spear over his crazy clothes. And Doc and Johnny did the same thing. Doc dressed up wild and it gave him something to talk about. And my idea was I just came out in my other suit, which was gray, I think. And the contrast to Doc's flamboyant personality and everything just gave them a lot of ammunition for for shots at me and you know, a lot of gags.
So did you intentionally kind of dress down so that you could be the opposite of Doc, or did you always dress that way anyways?
That was my normal state, really, because I'd never been in front of anything until this job. You know, I was always just a member of the band.
Mm-hmm.
I was never a band leader. A couple of weddings and bar mitzvahs, bands, but that was it.
What was it like for you the first time that you filled in for Doc Severinsen and you had to do the opening banter with Johnny?
Well, it's pretty stunning, you know, because you're out there in front of the public, and the lights are hitting you, and it's like being suspended in space. I was just trying to get out alive.
What was it like for you? You know, playing in a jazz band on The Tonight Show when more and more rock singers started coming on?
Well, you feel a little like the times are changing. And, you know, you know, the kind of the handwriting was on the wall because there we were, and most of the groups that came in were self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
And we play a version of rock, but it's, you know, it's not the real thing. You know, it just can't be done. It's apples and oranges. So, you kind of see the end of the road there. And by golly, there it is.
Well, how do you feel about the end of the road? How do you feel about the show ending?
Well, everything has to come to an end. It's too bad because it's a very, very pleasant way to go, believe me. The money's nice, and the working conditions are great. And it's like a four-day-a-week job, not bad.
What have the members of the band been doing about their futures? Are people looking for other jobs now?
God, well, I don't know. I'm going to lighten up on my schedule a little bit personally, and I'm going to pursue. I do a lot of writing anyhow, so I'm going to pursue that more. And I've got some personal appearances, like it's some jazz festivals this summer. And we'll just see what happens. Doc's got a lot of engagements with the band and a 3-week tour this summer and a lot of weekends. So there'll be things. It'll be just a little leaner, a little slimmer pickings, I imagine.
Has this week felt very different than other weeks on the show?
Yeah, a little bit.
What's felt different about it?
Well, it starts to dawn on you that this is really it, you know. Sometimes you think there's going to be word from the governor.
A reprieve.
Yeah. Hey. GK and Nock has been a great run. just a great run.
The show seemed very special to everybody this week, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the last month or so, they've been that way, and it's getting more so, but they're really good shows. And I don't know, I think Carson is more relaxed than ever, and that has caused it to be even, you know, it has a warmer feeling.
You get the feeling Carson doesn't want to go.
Well, I'll bet he would. In about a month, he wish he hadn't left. Because, you know, how many tennis balls can you hit?
What are you going to do when the show's over?
Then we go to Johnny's house and have a party.
I imagine that'll be some party.
I'll bet. It's the first time I've been there.
Really? Is that the first time you've been to Johnny Carson's house? I guess he doesn't have a lot of people over.
He's never been to my house either, so it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if it wasn't for Carson, there wouldn't have been a big band this long on the show? If someone else who was less of a jazz fan than he was were hosting?
That's right, yeah. That's absolutely true. I think it would have been gone long ago. Because the guys with the pencils, you know, they figure... You know, Merv Griffin did it. He cut down to six pieces and then to three. And all of the current shows have small bands. It's money. Money, and of course, the style of music has changed, too. But you can't have a big band sound without a big band. That's it. And that was Johnny's cup of tea, a big band.
Well, listen, good luck with the last show.
Oh, thank you.
And with whatever you are doing after it ends. And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Tommy Newsom. Well, we've got a holiday weekend ahead, and all of us at Fresh Air hope you enjoy it. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a concert of Cole Porter songs with singer Barbara Lee. And detective writer Lawrence Block tells us about his creation, Private Eye Matt Scudder, who used to be hard drinking but lately has given up alcohol. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.